This is Terry Gibson, Gnostic Cinema, 8th of October 1994, tape 2 of 4.
These men have Eros in their life. Yeah, and she turns out to be a shibboleth. She turns out to have no Eros either. There's, you know, it's a constant, that's what the despair of this film is, a constant look for Eros in this culture. Some Eros that will get us connected to. I want to ask that, where is the self here? We see Kronos, we see ego in all the ways we see it in the garden. We see ego in the cynicism of Johnny and the kind of street wiseness and street toughness.
Well, it isn't a projection. The self is projected out onto the female.
And absolutely.
That's why we say it's cruel, because self is in a sense taken away in that
moment. Absolutely. And you get a sense, it was wonderfully done. You know, they all, and then they walk along these square, faceless windows, and then all of a sudden, what happens? Round and it's numinous, the light is much softer. It has penumbral light around. It's kind of like that, you know, round, the Gnostics talk about penumbral, mandalic light, like the morning when he woke up and he had the little umbrella, bamboo umbrella, and that wonderful penumbral as he wakes up and he sees it above him, and it looks like a mandala shimmering above him. It kept the sand off him at night. Remember when he woke up and that wonderful visual image, it's almost like the rays of the sun above him. There's this penumbra, and inside it is the anima projection. The two men looking through the blinds, shy and yet also filled with lust. There's this double having these conversations. And of course, Johnny gets right to it. He starts to talk to him. He says, well, I don't know, you're like a boffer or whatever. I mean, it's a typical kind of street. I mean, he gets cruelly too much to it. But he is chanted by the image, too. And the thing about Johnny's ego illness is anytime he really sees himself, he has to go and defile her. He's afraid to let her in. He's afraid to let her touch him. So he has to go and defile it every time it's around. The one guy's afraid to approach her and will yearn too long. The other guy wants to defile it. Crisis of our time with dealing with spiritual energies. The Pentagon wants to kill it the minute the soul appears, and the rest of it are too shy and wait too long. But it is there. I think genuinely there's a possibility. She's there. It's a religious ritual for this guy. The deepest part of this day's meaning, you know, is to come and stare at her through this window. It's the only place he feels any kind of depth in this kind of bizarre thing of marking time between his anxiety and his guilt in reading these faceless novels, is to look at her and to protect her and be with her, to witness her.
So more of self-reflection in the interaction between the two.
Yeah, yeah. And it was tender. And I agree that scene on the stairs where she's sitting, the guard's sitting head on, Johnny's sitting to the side, still drilling at him. The guard's got his whole worldview been taken away from him. Man, Johnny's demolishing. Boom. Like one of those pile drivers. But even Johnny's pace is slowing down, and I think he's starting to pace in and develop, despite himself, his best instinct, some kind of empathy with this man. The man was full of despair. Because he's breaking this guy's whole careful worldview. The excitement the guy had was, I got you. You said you were into the apocalypse, but then you just said, you imagine it's going somewhere. He says, oh, no, the apocalypse is just the surface of evolution, mate. We'll disappear. I mean, it was that. But he had some eros. He thought, well, he could hold on to his worldview and he could matter to this guy. So some dialogue going back and forth. So there is sometimes some poignance, some empathic poignance in what could develop between these two men. That they don't have to now triangle a woman in to connect. That's what patriarchs do, you know. They can't relate directly often, so they try and find a woman and triangulate her. And it's two men in an empty space starting to deal with the real waste of their lives and the structures they're in. It's touching there. I think that may have been one of the things you're picking up, is that I think there's a real hunger now. Particularly, men may have been even more damaged by the patriarchal assumptions because they're more genetically encoded in them, maybe. But for men to have genuine conversations without having to project or detour or split it off onto the feminine, for them to take full responsibility for their anguish and to talk about it. There's a poignance in the way these two men, I think, are trying to do that a little bit.
I think in feeding the arrow from two men, too, not just the men, but then later in the sandwiches, and he says, you make these?
Yeah.
You know, and there's a sense that that the nourishment, the nurturance, the feminine aspect of the father, mother, moment. It's not just the masculine figure feminine there, but it's coming through the male.
Oh, very much. And you thought he was going to get cynical about that, and he didn't. And the kind of touching moment where he finally said, thank you, early on. It's really hard. But then again, the guard's kind of done in a Tupperware, carefully done container. It's under his arm. No one's going to get to his sandwiches unless they offer. The world wants your food. You got to be careful. He's kind of standing there. It's just the sadness of the rigidity of his life.
Still, they tolerated the closeness for an awfully long time.
Mm-hmm. In that empty space. Mm-hmm. And it's Johnny. I think the guard could have bore it a lot longer. It's Johnny. Really, you see that Johnny's even more fallen. He can't bear it. He has to go out and actually then deface. It's a really brutal subsequent set of scenes where he goes up and just intentionally seduces this woman to rub the guard's face.
He's scared to death of the influence.
Absolutely.
And he has to go get it out.
Absolutely. Now, I want you to see this because I don't think there is a lot of the self is there, but these men both have our enormous difficulties of accessing it and letting it come to us in a transformative way because, I'm going to suggest to you, I think Michael Lee's saying, we're losing initiatory temenosis, places that are protected, like that boat in Woman of the Dunes, the dream boat, where we can have depth experience in protected places with guardians who themselves have been initiated. We don't have that in our culture. In fact, this film, I won't tell you all, but the film ends in despair with all the major figures just limping off into their lives. They know the problem and they can even name it by the end of the film, but they can't generate any safe place to change it. And it is the crisis of our culture. Michael Lee leaves you there, wounded him. But it is a terrible, it's a very crushing ending for me.
But that scene there is like a comment on the reality of our time.
Oh, absolutely.
Talk about death and rebirth that can't touch it.
And it really is, I think Michael Lee believes that we are at a millennial time, that we have created an apocalyptic time of crisis. And it seems like millennially that happens. That the great kind of unconscious zeitgeist, the archons have gotten so asleep and so dead and it's so chaotic that, as Johnny says, that we'll need some kind of apocalypse that'll jumpstart, it'll either kill us or jumpstart us into another part of our development. And you get a sense there's a vast part of the globe that's asleep. And when it breaks out in massacre. I mean, there's these extraordinary events of slaughter, the Persian Gulf War, this thing in Uganda. I mean, all over the world now. There's kind of the Cambodia thing in the last 20 years. The Holocaust are almost, we can't even keep them in consciousness. When it starts appearing, it's like it just spills out in venom and rage. So here we are. So now how do you create your flat bottom? You're in the despair. What do you do with the despair? How do you go and create temenos? What does it mean? Where do you go to take your yearning for the soul, to take your yearning for her through this window? Where do you go not to defile her, but to let her in a transformative way? Martin Scorsese has an image. We'll look at this, talk about it, and then take a break. The Last Temptation of Christ. But again, I think Martin Scorsese was working with Gnostic symbols. It's interesting, the scriptwriter, his favorite scriptwriter, did Taxi Driver and did the script for this guy named Paul Schrader. Paul Schrader has written the most thoughtful volume. It's on the bibliography, on the Transcendent Film. He's a brilliant guy. One of the things I'd love to, I don't know anything about this man, but I have a fantasy. I'd love to get a grant. My idea is, as an analyst, I'd like to be on the set from the beginning of when one of these directors, like Schrader being my favorite, when they get the idea about directing a film, be with them all the way through the process and just interview them to kind of get some sense about how conscious they are about process. And just kind of talk with them, in a way, just find out what goes on, kind of listen with them, like a kind of late night over dinner. So the whole experience, just to kind of see what happens in the art, how they assemble this, how it's an individuating experience. And Schrader's a man I particularly appeals to because he does obviously think about these things. I mean, the transcendent, I wanted to show you what he takes Dreyer and Uzo, another Japanese director, and he. These are particularly stylized directors, and he says they all share a commonness, the European and Japanese, in the way that they work with the transcendent. So I want to put these up, too, to see if they show up in Schrader, if we notice this in the way that Schrader scripts this scene. See if you notice these aspects that he says seem to be recurrent in gifted directors when they really want to talk about the transcendent. It's these qualities about how, when you're stuck in this glue, how do you get a transformative energy up? He says, first of all, most of these filmmakers will work hard to celebrate the everyday. They celebrate the bare threshold of existence. Did you notice how in Woman of the Dunes, how the everyday was celebrated in that household? Celebrates, and it's a bareness about it, and yet it's beauty. The bare threshold of existence, those banal occurrences which separate the living from the dead, the physical from the material, prepares reality for the intrusion of the transcendent. I like that. And you notice this careful attention to the interior of Teshigahara's. It shows the interior of her home and the domestic lifestyle. And spend some time on not only the beauty of her body, but the scars on her back. And it's almost like seeing that prepares us for the transcendent. But by closing all the loopholes for the artificial insertion of fantasy, folk myth, stylization of the static, the monotone, the bland, the predictable. So what he wants to do is a good director will close the loopholes so the artificial and yet deep insertion of initiating fantasy and folk myth will show up. So let's see if Schrader does that. See if he presents the everyday and sets us up to intrude the transcendent. Disparity then, insertion of human density into the cold. Always they show the cold context of the everyday. It's there, but like Michael Lee in Naked shows us the cold context of the world that we live in. The fabulous needs such a human density. Actually a spiritual density, a boundless compassion. That density was there when we were moved, when he says, would you like a mint? We're moved by Johnny's density. And we're moved by the guard that could say, would you like a mint? He says, there's a kind of a real touch. There's something spiritual in the heaviness of Johnny. And the heaviness of the guard moves us. When we see him heavy on the stairs with his worldview crushed in a 3-hour theological dialogue. A boundless compassion. Again, that mystical, what I call the mystical sorrow. Sophia appearing. Marked by solemnity and suffering. I love his language. An extension of holy agony. Can we feel holy agony? And when we watch, let's see if Schrader and Scorsese can create a mood of holy agony for us. Leads to a decisive action. It's excruciating attention in the everyday, but will lead to decisive action. A totally bold call for emotion which dismisses any pretense of everyday reality. Breaks the everyday stylizations. The transcendent intrudes and we feel her presence. And then stasis. The everyday, then the disparity, the intrusion, and then it kind of, these films leave us with a stasis. It kind of freezes what we've experienced. A frozen view of life which does not resolve the disparity but transcendence. A quiescent view of life in which the mountain is again a mountain. An image of a secondary reality which can stand beside the ordinary reality. It represents the holy other. In other words, the things we were presented before, we're going to see again, but we're going to have a deeper depth about the mountain that we saw at the beginning of the film, or the Jesus we saw at the beginning of the film. We're going to feel differently about this Jesus, or this John. We're going to feel differently about this Zeke. It represents, it's formalistic in comparison to the experiential qualities of disparity in the everyday. Transforms empathy into aesthetic appreciation. Experience into expression, emotions into form. It's often like classical religious art, an iconographic frozen frontality. I think what he's talking about is a mood of deep contemplatio, is what the alchemist did. We are moved, and then there's this quiet moment of just reverence and joining with the images, and we feel deep soul in a quiet, static moment. So let's watch. Let's see if Paul Schrader, when he goes to work, when he really does his craft, when he writes a script, he's directed films too, but here he's the script writer. Let's see if he and Scorsese, if they look at the crisis of the everyday, if they present, build us for an introduction of the fabulous transcendent, and then they can put it into a kind of a contemplative freeze frame for us to kind of take as an image that we could leave there. Let's see if he can do it in this brief vignette. What we're going to see, when you've seen The Last Temptation of Christ, this particular scene is where, and as you know, Katzenzakis just turns everything on its head. He just takes the evidence, between the lines evidence and the synopsis. The Christos in the story disappears from age 12 to 30. Katzenzakis says, fair game for an artist to write about this. And the answer here, so what we get is that Magdalene and Christ were lovers, and he got this idea that he was the Messiah. He can't get it out of his head. He has these dreams of this red-headed guy who says he's Judas that kept saying, you're the one. And he doesn't believe it, so he makes crosses. It's a way to prove he's not a Messiah. He makes crosses and helps Rome and crucifies fellow Jews. It's a way to kind of get... And he tells Mary, but I can't marry you and run off and we can't start a family because I'm this Messiah. So she goes off to become a local prostitute. So Barbara Hershey does a marvelous job. And there's scenes where And he loves her, and yet he can't get enfleshed with her because there's other stuff in his room. He goes in here in the room where she's, where the prostitution was, there's men on both walls, and there's one after the other. He just sits there and watches her. He just tears his heart out. He's doing this kind of stuff. But finally, it just emerges. He gets the idea. He gets different themes. He knows he needs to love. This idea has occurred to him. And people start showing up around him. He can do remarkable things. And we're going to see him now. He's gotten this idea. And the thing, Judas is a zealot. The warriors that wanted to have an army, and the Messiah was going to lead them and destroy Rome. And Judas says, "You've said you're a prophet of the Messiah, but if you don't overthrow Rome, I'm going to kill you. If you don't turn into a warrior, so I'm going to walk along with you." And Judas gets converted along the way. Along the way, Jesus gets this idea, goes to a monastery in the desert, and decides he has to go kind of do a walkabout. The baptizer. So he says, "I'm going to go to John the Baptist, because John maybe will tell me who I am. I don't know who I am. I'm troubled with who I am." He's burdened by this responsibility, and yet he wants it. He really wants to know. It's kind of like, you've got a disease, you want it diagnosed. Well, he's got something eating him, he wants it. Is he really the Messiah? Who in the world is he? So he goes to the baptizer, and this is where the scene is. It's where it takes up, and I think it's really, a Gnostic exploration of these themes. And the way we presented those, at the bottom of despair, how can we get some transformative heat generated to do something about it? That's pretty much what he's going to see. We're going to see. I think this is.
Again, but you will never understand. You may look and look, but you will never know. These people with our soul, their ears are deaf, and their eyes blind.
False prophets, false idols, worship of gold. No. rough. You have to take the axe and cut it down.
If I was a woodcutter, I'd cut it. If I was a fighter, I'd burn. But I'm a heart, and I love. That's all I can do.
I'm a heart also. But I can't love what's unjust. What I can't love, I attack. God demands it.
Anger?
Yes, God demands anger.
Anger? But we're all brothers.
You think love is God's only way? Go to the Dead Sea. Look in the bottom. You'll see two whores, Sodom and Gomorrah. That's God's way. On the day of the Lord, blood will flow from wood. The stones of the houses will come alive and kill their owners. That day is here. He gave me the axe, now I give it to you.
That's not the answer.
Then what is the answer?
I don't know.
But if you won't listen to me, who will you listen to?
God.
The God of Israel's God of the desert. If you want to speak to him, then you'll have to go to the desert.
I prefer to be here. Thank you, Baptist.
Be careful. God isn't alone.
I feel sorry for you. You were lonely. You cried. So I came.
Thank God for you. Who are you?
Your spirit.
My spirit?
You're afraid of being alone. You're just like Adam. He called me and I took one of his ribs and made it into a woman.
You're here to trick me.
Trick you? To love and care for a woman to have a family. This is a trick. Why are you trying to save the world? Aren't your own sins enough for you? What arrogance to think you can save the world. The world doesn't have to be saved. Save yourself. Find love. Look in my eyes. Look at my breasts. Do you recognize them? Just nod your head, and we'll be in my bed together.
We're both bigger than that.
All right.
You don't recognize me?
I'm you.
I'm your heart. Your heart is so greedy. It pretends to be humble, but it really wants to conquer the world.
And I don't want a kingdom on earth. The kingdom of heaven, isn't it?
You're a liar! When you were making crosses for the Romans in Nazareth, your head was exploding with beams of power. Power over everyone. You said it was God, but you really wanted power. Now you can have what you want. Any country you want. All of it. You could even have Rome.
Liar. Step into my circle so I can pull your tongue out. Be afraid. You are one.
My work is done. Now I can die. The Lord wants me to tell you to stand up. His day is here. Take this axe. Take this message to everyone.
Already, silence is better.
like that in the desert. Tell me the truth. Don't you miss Lobez? Tell me a home, a real life.
I admit it. I'd like it, but I'll never have it.
Listen, if you really want God, don't spend your time in the desert. He's not there. He's right here. Read your scriptures. God doesn't want you to fast and pray. He wants you to make children.
Mary, you're making him uncomfortable again. He knows what I'm talking about. Come help me. It's not right to taste this man. I haven't tasted it. Remember the Baptist? There's nothing to tease about.
The Baptist what?
He's dead. He was killed by Herod. You know?
They said if he was drunk, they said he probably said.
We don't know the Baptist said that.
Nobody knows what
he
said.
He's
saying that the world of God is here now.
But he just meant that. Continue my work. Continue to do the same work that only right here at the Jordan River Elijah's going to say, doesn't that mean something to you?
We're waiting here. We're waiting here.
That's what I love about you, Peter. You're as steady and as solid as a rock. Nobody can change your mind. What good are you?
Master. Rabbi. John heard your footsteps in his heart. And we were preparing to welcome you.
Were you baptized?
Yes.
John baptized with water and they killed him. Now I baptize with fire.
Is that what the Baptist told you?
I have an invitation for you.
Is there a celebration?
No. I'm not inviting you to a celebration. I'm inviting you to a war. My heart. It's vacant. God is inside of us. The devil is outside us in the world all around us. We'll pick up an axe and cut the devil's throat. We'll fight him wherever he is. In the sick, in the rich, even in the temple. I'll lead you. If you have sheep, give them away. If you have a family, leave them. I believed in love. Now I believe in this. Who's with me?
What does Scorsese and Schrader say about when you hit the bottom, what do? Who do you listen to? Where you? How do you listen? Where do you go to listen? Johnny and the guard want to listen. What do you do? Okay, you create a safe space. First thing, he's a good Sardello kind of person. He went back to the earth. Go to the river. One thing, find an earth place. Then what do? And you go there in community. Another interesting thing, you don't go alone. It's a really interesting thing, I think, about truth. You don't go alone. The Gnostics, you don't go alone. You're always in community. They didn't believe in big communities. They believed in very small communities where people really knew each other. But you don't enter the unconscious alone. You always enter from community and return to community. You go to an earth place. And who do you find at the earth place? Who do you listen to at the earth place? You find a companion. Somebody that anoints you. That's all animals do. They're just anointers. If you've ever been into therapy, if you're a therapist yourself, what you should do the first time come in and walk past the other turn and say, who are you? That's the way to start the session. Oh, God, this is one. Oh, that's a great therapy. Who are you? No. Jesus is pretty cunning. He doesn't really know either, but who do you think I am? You had clients like that. Who do you think I am? Who do you think I am? But you go and find an anointer. You find somebody that has done this themselves, that's initiated themselves, that has some kind of process and an initiatory capacity about them. And clearly John the Baptist was an initiator. Some people thought he was wild, but he was close to the instincts. I mean, wild man. He lived in a river, had instinctual, brought that up in people, but you go to somebody that has some experience around powerful, knowing how to build a temenon, knowing about the fearful forces. I mean, I love the way he said, be careful, God's not alone out there. You're not alone out there. Jung lived on the edge of the Holocaust. Murray Stein's here a couple of weeks ago, he's written a lot about the Holocaust, this our kind of modern Gnostic struggle about how could we go that crazy? We threw 13 million innocent human beings in the oven just 50 years ago. Mainline Protestantism did that. A lot of darkness, so you need a community and you need an initiator that's knowledgeable. It's a wonderful passage. If you ever read the actual book, Katanzaka says, John the Baptist and Jesus, you know, you see the Judas character spying on him from above and yet fascinated too, waiting for him to make a goof so he'd kill him, but also fascinated. But Katanzaka said, John the Baptist and Christ passed the moon back and forth between them, passed the orb of the world and said, no, you take it at yours, no, it's yours. Under the full moon, they pass the earth back and forth. They want the burden. And then, the same thing, an intimate conversation. And then, yes, you've alluded, you didn't go out alone. But it's very much, I mean, it's, any of you that have ever done a vision quest with a Native American tradition or done somebody, it's all set up very much like this. Careful preparation, kind of a community thing. You're taken to an earth place, but you're taken by the in the Lakota Sioux tribe, from me, you're taken by the holy person. Sikawahan, the holy person knows about these things. You're taken and left there, and they know who you are, and they come and get you when you're done. You're not deposited out there alone, but you go out to face the earth alone. And great traditions across the globe, very kind of archetypally similar. And then you build that protected space. And the courage. I'm not leaving here till you come and talk to me. Not in symbols. I want to understand it. I'm not going to leave here till I understand what in the world it is you really want of me. Takes a lot of guts. It's kind of talking back. None of this Jungian bungo jungo stuff. I want a straight up, no chaser. What is it you want? It just makes the timorous any weight. And then just like Robert Sardella says, we need a recovery of dream, vision, myth, metaphor, and I'd say film, is powerful visionary experience. Powerful mediated experience. And then when you've had that, when you've touched the self, it is the self. It is the darkness of the self and the lightness of the self. It is the fruit of the self and the temptation. It weathers all of that. And you individuate that. And then you come back, what do you do? When you leave the tunnel, you have these experiences, what do you do with them? And you go back to community. You return. There's a wonderful scene. I mean, that Cousins art is a visceral imagination. He's reading in and pulling his own beating heart out. I mean, the community shares in a kind of altered state of consciousness with him. He comes back and they share the kind of common vision. He's getting the second part of the truth right. The first part was love, and the second part's got to have some fierceness to it, whatever his individuated journey. He gets a third part before the end of the film. But I think there's a lot of initiatory information in the Gnostics' belief. You have to have a community. You have to have people that are wise in that community that have done it before. The ancient monastic vows they believed in. The vow of poverty, to agree to be poor in spirit. To never, never get so arrogant or isolated or locked in that you aren't willing to give a mint to somebody in the doorway of a building that's got menthol in it. To be poor in spirit, to share your space that you're guarding with the bushes and the 23 stations, to be chaste, to never violate your eros or the eros of another human being. Johnny goes out and violates eros, about the friend he was making of that woman in the film. But that's what that's really what it gets all tied up in literal chastity. What they meant was to be chaste with your eros. And then to be obedient to just authority. Not any authority, but the authority of the self. Those are the ancient three monastic vows that most Gnostic communities share. And you need to have a community.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.